so I guess you do. You will need that outline. We have no other choice other than to use the overhead in this way, so we've checked it out once, and Jim went back there to look at it, and Jim could see it. But if you tried to play like this was a drive-in movie and you were out in the parking lot, you wouldn't be able to see it. And that's where we are for this evening, Ezekiel chapter 22. Ezekiel 22. What does it mean to stand in the gap? Before I come back to the text, and we work directly from Ezekiel 22, I want to bring to your attention someone who did stand in the gap. Now, there are those of you who are not here last Sunday night, so you may be wondering, what does this mean to stand in the gap? Standing in the gap, and be patient with us while we try to get our levels set here. Standing in the gap is that individual who responds to the call of God to come and stand in the breach in the wall, the moral, spiritual wall of God's people that has been broken through. It's a word picture, actually, the terminology gap, which comes out of Ezekiel 22, verses 30, 31. The picture is built, it's a metaphor, and the actual experience of a gap in the wall is where a battering ram would have broken through the wall and two things happen. People can go out and would try to rush out if they could to get away from the invading army. But the invading army comes rushing in, floods into the city. This picture is used by Ezekiel as one of his many word pictures. The prophets are loaded with these vivid pictures to get us to see the seriousness of the circumstances and what God was doing among his people. And this particular circumstance was that the flood of the judgment of God in upon Israel by means of the Chaldean army. But the breach in the wall has been created, though, because of Israel's sinful, their path of covenant disobedience. And the nation has disintegrated. It has fallen apart. And God was looking for someone to come and stand between him, a holy God, just, righteous in his ways, with his standard as set forth in the Mosaic law, in the covenant. When we come back to the passage in a minute, you'll see the areas in which Ezekiel, where he identifies the breakdown and collapse of the nation, what had happened to the people. And there is the call of God to stand in the gap between the holy God, his law, which has been broken, and a sinful people who are experiencing all of the destruction, the catastrophe that comes with disobedience. To stand in the gap and say, stop, and speak on behalf of God. Someone in leadership to do that. I want to tell you about someone who stood in the gap. Well, we're cozy enough down here, I can even let you see some of the pictures that I have here. And here's comes from the Christian History magazine, and this issue was devoted to William Wilberforce. And here's a picture of William Wilberforce. He is not a very imposing-looking person. You see the title of the article here, The Shrimp Who Stopped Slavery. William Wilberforce was born on August the 24th, 1759. He was the third child of Robert and Elizabeth Wilberforce. He grew up in wealth. And growing up in this wealthy home created privilege for him. Privilege which God in his providence used. At a very early age, after excellent training, good education, Wilberforce was elected to the parliament in one of the most prestigious of all of the parliamentary seats. and it was from in Yorkshire, and that was in 1784. Wilberforce became a believer young in life, and when he became a believer, he also, with his sense of duty before God, he became, really a committed Christian. He, an avid student of the Scriptures, but a great concern over the moral and spiritual condition of Great Britain. Now let me pause and say something about Great Britain in the time in which Wilberforce was born and when he served in Parliament in the 1700s, up into the early part of the 1800s. The Industrial Revolution had come into England, and people were living under the bountiful tree of the Industrial Revolution. There was a lot of prosperity. The Industrial Revolution had created wealth. It had created a middle class, and there were people who just had millions, incomparable in American dollars, millions of dollars. Wilberforce came up in one of those homes. But one of the tragedies that occurred that really made it possible for the Britons to live with such affluence and prosperity in the 1700s was a social blight, was a tragedy in human beings, and it was the slave trade. And thousands of slaves were packed into ships, and England was trafficking in the slave trade. Well, when you can have free labor by slaves, you can guarantee an increased amount of wealth. And so it was in England. Wilberforce, after he became a believer and then came into Parliament, he looked at what he saw not only in the slave trade, but in the factories as well. Life in the factories, you ever read any of Charles Dickens' novels and you get a little feel for that time. Life was bleak. Long, long hours. And there were no child labor laws. I mean, you had children and women working just without any of the amenities that you would you experience in a factory in life today. Well, someone saw these evils. And that someone was William Wilberforce. As I said, he grew up surrounded by wealth, and he immediately began to passionately give himself to going after these social evils, among other things. Let me just tell you a few of the things that he accomplished. Wilberforce went after, it has been estimated that Wilberforce, dubbed the Prime Minister of a Cabinet of Philanthropists, was at one time active in support of 69 philanthropic causes. He gave away a fourth of his annual income to the poor. He also gave an annuity to Charles Wesley's widow from 1792 until her death in 1822. I mean, he took up her expenses, her needs. He fought the cause of climbing boys, chimney sweeps, and single mothers. He sought the welfare of soldiers, sailors, and animals, and established Sunday schools and orphanages for criminal poor children. His homes were havens for the marginalized and dispossessed. Now, Wilberforce was not physically a man of robust health and strength. As a matter of fact, Wilberforce's health was blighted by weak and painful eyes, a stomach prone to colitis, and a body that for many years had to be held upright by a crude metal frame. He was very very sick and weak physically much of his life. But he served in Parliament for a considerable length of time and went after the slave trade as well as these. Let me now give you some other of the achievements. He contributed to the Christianization of British India by securing chaplains to the East India Company and missionaries to India. He worked with Charles Simeon and others to secure parishes for evangelical clergy, thus shaping the future of the Church of England. As early as 1789, he achieved some success in having 12 resolutions against the trade, that is, the slave trade, passed. Let me cut quickly to the conclusion here, perhaps one of the greatest of the contributions, is that he persisted in pushing through Parliament legislation, law, to abolish slavery throughout the British Empire. I mean, he was met with fierce resistance. You can imagine this when people, the wealth of people is depending upon the slave trade. As a matter of fact, when he won and pushed through the law abolishing slave trade, the next election that came up, his opponent spent over £200,000. I mean, that's millions of dollars to try to get to defeat Wilberforce. He was always under great attack and pressure. But Wilberforce persisted, and finally on February the 23rd, 1807, they secured the abolition of slavery by 283 votes to 16. The House cheered. Wilberforce wept with joy. And it's an exciting story to read as to what this man accomplished. Frail of health, committed to the Lord, and he had others around him. I could have mentioned the Clapham's group, the Clapham sect, as they were called. These were other wealthy philanthropists who lived in Clapham, which was a village out in the south of London at that time. They were all well endowed. Most of these people had just inherited wealth, with the exception of one or two, and they devoted themselves and their inherited wealth to attacking and going after the social ills of their day, and made some significant turnarounds. Many say that it was through their efforts and through that. See, this was a result of, I mustn't get too far off track, because this ties into something else you're familiar with, and that is the revivals of Wesley and Whitfield in the 1700s. And it kept England, probably kept in the providence of God, I think it's safe to say that it kept England from going over the precipice into a revolution the likes of which France experienced under Napoleon, late 1700s, early 1800s. There was a man who stood in the gap, gave himself, his life, for a variety of things. World missions, going after social ills, involved in politics. You heard the list. Do we get the picture of what it means to stand in the gap? In other words, here was someone who stood up and said, "Stop! This is wrong! Stop!" And gave his whole life with that kind of commitment. Well, let's come back and let's see then what standing in the gap means by the prophet of Ezekiel, prophet Ezekiel. Here's what we did last week. There are some of you who are not here, so let me get you up to speed with us. We went through and explained exactly what is involved in standing in the gap. You note we're lifting this from verse 30, chapter 22. In this chapter, I see, therefore, three requirements for gap people. You want to be a gap person? You don't have to have inherited wealth like Wilberforce, but God, I'm telling you, listen to me, God has endowed you with something. He's given you natural gifts. He's given you spiritual gifts. He's given you a sphere of influence. He has given you, most of all, He's given you of His salvation in Jesus Christ. Don't write yourself off as a gap person. God's looking for gap people. And here is what is involved. Gap people must understand, number one, gap people must understand the conditions that have created the gap. Now, what has created the gap? They're enumerated in Ezekiel 1 to 12, as well as on verses 23 to 29. The cheapening of human life is one of these conditions that created this enormous gap through which the enemy was flooding. And that Israel, having been called of God to identify itself among the nations by putting great value on human life, was cheapening life. I'll come back to this in a minute, where you see the shedding of blood. The city became a bloody city. The crime rate, violence, went to just off the charts in the city of Jerusalem. Secondly, the pursuit of false gods, idolatry, the commitment to a world and life view, if I may put it in contemporary terms, a world and life view that was resistant to the God who called him. I mean, this is just such an embarrassing reversal of spiritual life in the nation that it just freezes you in your steps. Think, what could bring a nation, a covenant people like Israel, having been given the legacy, the Ten Commandments? Here we're quite interested in having the commandments hanging on the walls of our courtrooms, and I'm not against that by any means. I mean, that it is a sad day when we're trying to take that down and think we're solving a problem by doing it. But I want to tell you a little something. Having the Ten Commandments is no guarantee that you're going to keep your nation from falling apart. Israel had the Ten Commandments. There's something else that's got to go on besides having commandments. You've got to have the will to keep the commandments. And to have the will to keep the commandments, you've got to have a heart that has a will to keep the commandments. In order to have that heart, what do you have to have? Well, we sang, this is perhaps, I think, the last song that we sang tonight, based on Ezekiel 36, the new covenant, changing the hearts of people through the new birth. All right, we'll come back to that later. Now, we've seen that much with regard to this gap, the conditions that create the gap. Number three on the list is the perversion of power. Verse 6, the martyrdom of God's holy prophets, child sacrifice. This is all a part of the cheapening of life process. The lack of parental respect. There was, and you'll notice the degree to which the leadership of the nation was culpable here in working to destroy the family by their own poor family life, as well as law and example of a poor moral and spiritual example in that area. Number five, the lack of concern for those in need. Verse 7. God has sworn himself to be the protector of what people? The alien. This is the immigrant, the fatherless, the widow. These people, the disenfranchised, were being oppressed and were being abused, given their lack of strength and their defenseless position. You know, God built into the law of Israel, pause here with me a moment to think of what had happened. Israel had been given a law, a system of law, which is the greatest system of law the world has ever seen for the governing of a people and giving them an orderly life in protecting the poor. No nation has ever had a code like this. In Israel's law, and you see this scattered all through the Old Testament, Exodus 22, 23, and so on, that God established certain laws. And I want to mention, just breeze through them, just to show you how God put in place safety nets for people who would inevitably become poor. I mean, that's a given. There will be people who will become poor for varieties of reasons. But look at the safety nets that God built into the nation of Israel. In the first place, you remember the law of gleaning. The corners of the fields were to have been left so that the poor could have come in and have taken the grain off of those corners of the field, as well as that which was left just laying about on the ground. The traveler who was coming through the land could stop and could eat from the vineyard, as well as to take grain from the field as they were traveling through. That was the Deuteronomy 23. They could eat at their pleasure, and you were not to, no signs that said no trespassing or you will be shot or anything like that. Thirdly, they had one-third, every 3 years, one-tenth of income went to the poor, Deuteronomy 14. There was the principle of the sabbatical year, where every seventh year the land would have lain fallow, and what grew up in that year was there for the poor, the needy, to come and take that, and they could eat and survive and live on that. Also, the poor were given the privilege to partake in the festivals, the three great festivals, Feast of Weeks, Tabernacles, and Passover. When everyone, the men converged upon the city of Jerusalem, and there was food, there was plenty. It was a time like big Thanksgiving festivals. the poor were brought in and were allowed to participate in those events as well. So this shows you that there were was in Israel set in the law acts of loving responsibility laid out. But what's happened? Well, when you read passages like this, you can see that obviously all that went by the board. Now, you got to be asking a question here. What happened? What's going on? Why were people getting buried, as it were, in this avalanche of what? What was the avalanche that was burying the people and oppressing them and creating this gap between the haves and the have-nots? Well, let's go further. We'll see it unfold. Verse 8, here is another example of a condition that created the gap. The profaning of the things of God. You see, you have despised, in verse 8, see that, you have despised my holy things and profaned my Sabbaths. What were they doing? They were not observing the seventh day. They were ignoring the sabbatical years as well as the year of Jubilee. What was happening when they did that? Well, for one thing, it was keeping the poor from coming in on that sabbatical year, the seventh year, and taking what they would have needed. I mean, it would have crowded them out further to the margin of life. Also, in those years, in the seventh years, when there was a remission of debts, the debt service even became greater for those who had debts because there was no relief from the debt. In the year of Jubilee, if it were set aside, that is, every 50th year, that was the time when if you had lost your land, your property that had belonging to your family, it was to have come back to the original family. Well, you didn't observe that law, then what happens? You create getting these landowners, these few, who have an increasingly...